I could talk to the animals. Just imagine it, chatting to a chimp in chimpanzee. Imagine talking to a tiger, chatting to a cheetah. Oh, what a neat achievement that would be. If we could talk to the animals, learn their languages, maybe take an animal degree. I'd study elephant and eagle, buffalo and beagle, alligator, guinea pig and flea. I would converse in polar bear and python.
Today we welcome to the podcast someone who certainly shares the sentiments being expressed right now in the musical background, as Rex Harrison, as Dr. Doolittle, sings, "If I Could Talk to the Animals." Virginia Morell is a very well-accomplished science reporter generally, with a special interest in all those other living creatures. Her new book is titled Animal Wise, The Thoughts and Emotions of Our Fellow Creatures. And you're also very interested in your even more fellow creatures, those human beings who spend their lives studying those other creatures, the animals.
Yes.
And that's what we've got in your new book, Animal Wise. These are some very wise people studying the animals as well, I gather.
I think that they are, and oftentimes that's overlooked. But I was very curious when I read these reports about scientists, say, who discovered that rats laugh or that birds invent and make tools in the wild. I was always curious about who are these people who are spending their time either watching rats in the laboratory or birds in the wild and who bring back these discoveries. Who makes the rat press the lever?
You must instantly note and acknowledge that you are an anti-Cartesian. I speak of René Descartes.
Yes. Well, I think that overall, anyone who reports on evolutionary biology or any evolutionary biologist no longer accepts the notion that the body and the mind are two separate things. You know, that's really fallen to the wayside. Anyone in neurobiology doesn't look at the body-mind separation as René Descartes did.
But here's what Descartes has to say, one quotation. "It is a very remarkable fact that although many animals show more skill than we do in some of their actions, yet the same animals show none at all in many others. So what they do better does not prove that they have any intelligence. For if it did, then they would have more intelligence than any of us and would excel us in everything. It proves, rather, that they have no intelligence at all, and that it is nature which acts in them according to the disposition of their organs, in the same way that a clock consisting only of wheels and springs can count the hours and measure time more accurately than we can with all our wisdom." What he's saying is these are machines. And stimulus-response patterns stamped in by nature somehow are what account for what looks to us like intelligence or emotion in animals.
Yes, that was the old idea. But the problem with René Descartes and many philosophers who made these comments about animals is that they really didn't study the animals. They may have observed their pets or farm animals, but not to the degree that scientists are doing today. So we know, for instance, that many animals are not completely pre-programmed so that they can't alter their responses. I tell the story in Animal Wise about seeing some of these differences or different ways of reacting that strict animal behaviorists or people with a Descartian approach wouldn't say would be possible. I think my favorite one was watching two chimpanzees with Jane Goodall at her study site in Tanzania. And there she had a pair of chimpanzees that she was watching named Beethoven and Dilly. Beethoven was a very large adult dominant male, and he had adopted a young little female by the name of Dilly. And Jane gave Beethoven a huge stem of bananas. He made a lot of food cries when he got that bunch of bananas, which is the normal response that chimpanzees make when they see food. They make a food cry. And animal behaviorists would say, well, then that's the stimulus is the food and the response are the food cries. Beethoven proceeded to eat every single one of those bananas, didn't share a single one with poor little Dilly. But Jane had held one back. And when Beethoven fell asleep after eating this big meal, she showed little Dilly that she still had one that she in her hand, and she was putting it away from Beethoven's line of sight. He was asleep anyway. And when Dilly saw that banana, she did not make a food cry. She did not alert Beethoven to the fact that there was yet another banana. It was mum's the word. It was as if a secret message had passed between Jane and Dilly. Now, those kinds of things, behaviorists would say, cannot happen, that Dilly doesn't have a mind of her own, that she can't make intentional decisions. She should have responded with a food cry, all of these things, or the fact that she was capable of making a plan sort of with Jane, a secret plot that left out Beethoven, and then going over, eating the banana very, very quietly, and coming back, making soft little cooing sounds to make sure that Beethoven stayed asleep. Now, that kind of thing is what began to change the field.
Still, there's a way in which Beethoven disappoints me. As I read your setup of this incident in the book, what I anticipated or hoped for was a sign of altruism, that having eaten perhaps one banana, Beethoven would then offer Dilly another banana, but he did not do that.
Well, yes, one would hope that big Beethoven would be altruistic, but that's not necessarily something that we see in other animals. And I have to say, one of the funny things that I observed in the wild watching wild dolphins was the way that they would surface with a big fish in their mouth, and they would, especially if they'd been eating for a while, they might surface with a really fine prize catch and then sort of show it off to their buddies. And I asked the scientist, Richard Connor, I said, do they ever share their food when they have enough to eat? And he said, no, it's not at all about sharing. It's look at me, look at the fish I've got. You don't have one. I do. And so there's a lot more of that operating in the wild than we would like to see. But at the same time, you also see things such as elephants coming to the rescue of an infant elephant. And those kinds of things are very, very affecting.
And of course, also in the bird kingdom, where you tend to have a certain amount of infantile incapacity right after the birds are born, both the mothers and the fathers, depending upon the species, go out and forage and bring back food for the infants, don't they?
Yes, and certainly wolves do the very same thing, where they work together as a family to make sure that all the wolf pups are fed. They'll regurgitate, wolf pup comes up to them, licks them, and they certainly regurgitate. So you see this throughout the animal kingdom. You can see it in animals such as burying beetles, where the mother actually has her babies on her, and she makes a kind of a product that comes out of her skin, and they lap that up. So that is not uncommon, but that's your own, those are your own kids, and it's somewhat different where there's an animal that it isn't related to you genetically.
Still, there is a basic problem, a methodological problem, that does persist. That's one of the reasons why I've made reference to Dr. Doolittle and Rex Harrison singing If I Could Talk to the Animals. Despite many of the intelligent and kind of well-designed experiments that you report and which have been undertaken by various animal science persons around the world, the great gap is the linguistic gap. We cannot directly talk and have response from the animals that we study. So that finally, it's still conceivable that though they look intelligent and look emotional and vary from person to from animal to animal, perhaps, we don't have is any direct confirmation from them that, yes, I've been thinking about this. Yes, I understand what you're saying. Yes, I will comply or I won't comply with your request. There was the hope, I think, in the minds of some of the people who four decades ago, began to try to produce linguistic training for apes, particularly for gorillas and chimps, that they would be able to really communicate with humans, and thus we could share the animal mind, which we've never been able directly to do. Where do you stand on the controversy as to whether those animals, including Nim Chomsky, what was he called? Nim Chomsky.
Yes.
Whether they were or were not, in fact, capable of mastery of American Sign Language, at least.
Well, that's still debated, and there's a lot of problems with those studies. I suspect that there might be a certain degree of ability on the part of the apes. I bet scientists have actually made the most progress in communicating with another animal is both with parrots and dolphins. And it's much more likely that we'll have success doing that with these particular species because they share a similar ability with us, and that is that they are lifelong vocal learners. And what that means is that when they hear something, a sound such as a word or a chainsaw or something like that, they can imitate it. And we can do the same. For instance, when I heard your name this morning, you introduced yourself as Milt Rosenberg. I can immediately repeat that sound back to you because I'm a vocal learner. I learn words by hearing them. And the parrots, many species of parrots and certain species of dolphins and other whales have this ability too. And so that's why you see remarkable things with parrots where they're able to actually use words, which probably they're not words in that sense to the parrots. They're just a sound, but a communicative sound, but they can use them in the correct way. For instance, when I went to meet Irene Pepperberg, who worked with Alex, the African gray parrot, he was watching her try to teach one of the other parrots how to say the word green, and that parrot was having trouble and sort of saying grr, grr. And Alex, all on his own from the back of the room, just stood up on his cage and said, "Talk clearly. Talk clearly." And, you know, you just don't know what to make of that. But Irene responded as if indeed Alex knew what he was saying. And she told him to be quiet and not to be such a smart aleck. And she explained to me that he got bored listening to the other parrots because he already knew all of these things. And he thought the other parrots were a little bit on the slow
side.
Well,
in an incident like that, you clearly believe that there's a consciousness there in that parrot. And when he says talk clearly, he's learned that by rote in the past, but he knows that to be a signal to convey to someone else that more is required by way of vocal production than he is receiving. Are you attributing then to Alex actual consciousness, which means he's aware of his being a self, a separate entity, and he's giving a command to another entity that he takes to be responsive to his advice. Is he alive to all of this situation, or can it be a stimulus response complexly patterned, but still just stimulus response without awareness of oneself, without awareness of the real meaning of the present situation?
We could say the same things about ourselves.
Some have.
Are we really aware of what we're doing? I mean, that was the whole debate that Skinner brought up, you know, whether not only did any animals think at all, but did people, humans.
And his predecessor, John Watson, laid that out in the beginning of American behaviorism at the turn into the 20th century.
That's exactly right, and really set the field back in a lot of ways, because then you couldn't actually study thinking, which is, when you think about it, kind of remarkable, because it is something we all know that we do. And we also know that other animals have brains. That's where the mind resides. It's a physical place. It's a physical structure. They function, brains function very much alike across the animal kingdom. And when it comes to consciousness, my opinion is I basically agree with the scientists who have stepped forward and said a couple of years ago at the University of Cambridge, they had a meeting and several of, I think there are about a dozen who signed some statement saying that they believe that various species of animals have consciousness. I don't know why they presented only a select group. My own feeling is that until someone is able to show where in the brain consciousness is, what structure or what group of neurons fire in a particular way to create what we feel is consciousness, we can't study it. But if we were to find that particular part of the brain or the pattern of neurons firing that gives us this feeling, then we should be able to see whether or not there are comparable structures or comparable patterns.
Well, as you look at it.
But until that happens, it's sort of just a philosophical discussion. It doesn't really, to me, it doesn't mean anything until you show the biological basis for
it. I was about to ask you, as you look at, say, an ant colony on the move or a group of ants on the move across a forest space, and I've seen that, or as you watch bees doing their rather complex behaviors, do you assume that there's mind there in the sense of active conscious knowledge of one's own entity and one's own situation? Or can that at least be stamped in reflexively so that very complex stimulus response patterns instinctively are built into the nervous system, thus accounting for their effective lives and their evolutionary survival and persistence? There must be some point going down the phylogenetic scale where you have to worry there can't be consciousness this low down. As, for example, in ants. What do you think?
Well, it's true, but my main point is, does consciousness exist at all? Is it just something that we talk about, because we have no biological proof that it is something? It's just a—
Are you doubting that you
have
consciousness? But
I don't know what the term means, because I can't point to a place in the brain where it is. I mean, I feel that because I've been taught this is what consciousness is, but until, like, to me, until we find a particular structure in the brain or pattern of neurons, whatever, that shows that this is what causes this feeling, then it's something we can't say whether other animals have it or whether we
have it. Well, brain localization studies have advanced considerably in recent years, and we certainly do much better now than we did before in localizing many things.
That's true.
If you get rid of the frontal lobes, does consciousness in humans disappear?
Yeah, I'm not a specialist on that, so I can't say whether it does or it doesn't. You know, I don't know that we know.
Well, we do. I mean, we do have brain tumor data, which tends to— where sometimes very extensive removal through surgical procedures is required, and that wipes out most of the individuality of the suffering patient who still persists in life, but not really competent in speech or what have you.
Well, they certainly wouldn't be a competent human. Yeah. That's definitely the case. You know, it's not what we would expect a person to be like if they don't have their frontal lobes. But when we come to something like an ant, which the ant, you know, by itself, it doesn't really, you know, it can function for a certain amount of time, but it's not going to survive without its colony. So in the better way of looking at an ant colony that several people have written about, and I like their idea of comparing a colony of ants or colony of bees to a brain with the individual organisms acting as sort of the equivalent of neurons, and that, you know, they do— what's interesting is how those neurons or those individual ants work together to make group decisions. And that's one of the studies that I talk about in my book, Animal Wise, is the way that scientists are able to take a colony apart and look at the individual pieces as they go about making their decisions.
How do they do that?
Go ahead. Well, they do it first. They have to identify every individual ant. And that just shows us that, you know, individuals are important, whether it's in an ant colony or in a chimpanzee community or in a wolf pack, that individual animals matter. And you can't look at a colony and understand how all of those pieces function if you don't know who everybody is. So the researcher I went to spend some time with, Nigel Franks at the University of Bristol in England, was working with a small little ant about the size of a printed hyphen. They're known as rock ants. They live in rock crevices on the coast of England. And he would bring back a colony to his lab. There are about 200 members in a colony, so it's rather manageable. And he sets up a home for them in a CD jewel-sized case petri dish, glass petri dish. He makes a house for them out of microscope and glass slides, puts a little hole in the door in a piece of the cardboard so they can go inside and between those crevices, then set up home as they would out in the wild. And they put little pieces of gravel and doll dishes with water and honey and fly carcasses about for them so they have things to forage. And then everybody in the colony is painted. And he has to pick up the ants with flexible tweezers one by one, put them head first into a piece of foam beneath a microscope, and then he drops little dots of model airplane paint on each ant, so each one gets a different pattern. And that way, when he then videotapes them as they're facing what he calls his challenge tests, he can see what each individual ant does.
And
it's quite an undertaking.
And what does he observe?
Needless to say.
What does he observe?
Well, he has been able to show that these ants, if he gives them a test, say, for example, to figure out what kind of a house that they prefer to live in, what would be the best sort of home. So he has the main colony, and then he puts a couple of choice colony or areas outside the main petri dish. He sets up other petri dishes with homes of varying quality, you know, some that have more space, some that are smaller, some might have some dead ants scattered in the neighborhood. And then he puts bridges out to these other homes made out of cellophane tape, and then he destroys the home that they're living in by taking off the top slide, and then everyone's exposed to the elements, and oh my god, we've got to get out of here. So the scout ants head out first. They know their neighborhood, so they see these bridges and they go out in search of a new home, and then they come back to their nest and they start to lead other ants to, if they find what they consider a good home, then they start to lead other ants.
So he finds division of labor. You speak of scout ants. There are ants who specialize in finding new homes, as it were.
Well, they're the older ants in the colony, and as the ants grow up, they take on different roles in the colony. And so older ants become scouts, and they are the ones who know more about what's in the neighborhood. And they also know more about what makes a good home. And ultimately, the colony decides on a new house by basically voting with their feet. And when they reach a particular number of ants at a new house, then the other ants move there as well. And so he's been able to show that these ants are able to assess things such as how high a ceiling they want in their home, how much floor space they need, how many entrances it should have. They certainly are not going to move into a home that has dead bodies in the neighborhood. You know, they are definitely real estate appraisers.
As we run back up the phylogenetic scale to the animals that we spend much more time with, those of us who are not researchers doing stuff on ant colonies,
yes,
we come, of course, to the friend of man. The animal that we're most acquainted with, that we live with most commonly, is the dog. Cats
yes,
probably run a very close second. It would be a rare dog owner or friend of dogs who thought that his or her dog did not have awareness, consciousness, some vocabulary that is comprehension vocabulary,
yes,
though they don't speak to us, they just bark, though they may also have distinctive barks which communicate. And it would be a rare friend of dogs who doesn't also observe moods, emotions, happiness, misery, etc. in the dog. Yet there are others who argue we're anthropomorphizing dogs. They may also be machines without any awareness. But you have to reject that. It's just not plausible if you know a dog.
Yes, I agree with you on that one, absolutely. And I think the idea of this anthropomorphizing, it's been so overused. And actually, the scientists who I profile in my book, they use the fear of anthropomorphizing. They've turned it into a positive. And it's really more about having empathy for other beings and being able to put yourself, say, in the mind of an ant, or put yourself in the mind of an elephant, and to be able to think, well, what would this animal need to do? And then you can invent a test or an experiment of some sort, or just set up some kind of a situation, for instance, as they did with the elephants, where they wanted to see, did the elephants really recognize the skulls of other dead elephants, or did they bother with dead bones of other animals and the bones of other dead animals? And in fact, they didn't. They're only interested in the bones of dead elephants. So that shows us something about their feelings of grief for their own kind. So I think, you know, the same thing we can say for our dogs. We look at our dogs. We know they're empathetic with us. They watch our faces. They're very skilled at studying our faces and accepting all of our rules. One of my favorite stories from the scientists I met was that, you know, they said, dogs are so smart. They understand that we have rules in our home, and they also know that the rules are flexible. So sometimes it's okay to get on the couch, and sometimes it's not. And they very agreeably go along with those both of those rules. And they're changeable owners.
As I was reading your book, and particularly the stuff on dogs, I remembered a story I had from a friend many years ago when I was a graduate student. Beth Dillingham, and she and her husband were good friends of mine when we were all pursuing doctorates at the University of Michigan many, many years ago. Beth went and did a summer project, I think working towards her doctoral dissertation, with Kickapoo Indians down in Oklahoma. She spent 2 months or so there, and there was a dog, a little puppy, that was frolicking around, which everyone enjoyed, and Beth sort of played with that dog. And then one night there was a sort of a powwow or some sort of special celebration, a sort of a ceremonial meal, and they offered her something which had been very carefully roasted and was obviously a great delicacy. And she asked, "What is this?" And they said, "Well, it's that dog, you know, the one you were playing with this morning.
It's that puppy."
And she faced a terrible, she was aghast at this discovery. And she faced a terrible question. She had developed some companionship with her informants in this this tribal group on a reservation or a homestead. And she knew that if she turned the dog away and didn't eat it, she would lose some connectivity with them. And she forced herself to eat the dog, went out as quickly as she could from away from the group, and she said she vomited. Not that she intended to, but it was reflexive in her. Why didn't those Indians care more about the puppy dogs that they would have put aside the temptation to eat it?
Well, I can't speak for their cultural preferences,
culture, of course.
But it's well known that Native American peoples ate dog. They used dogs as their companions and to carry their goods, transport their goods, and they also ate them. There's a wonderful passage in the book Oregon Trail by Francis Parkman, and he relates when he's staying with the Sioux Indians. This is back in 1840, 1845, something like that. And he's been spending a day with a group of Indians in the village, and we're watching this elderly woman fix a meal, and she suddenly looks at these dogs, and one of them does something that she doesn't like. And she said, "Okay, that's it. I told you not to do that. You wouldn't listen to me, and so I'm sorry, but it's over for you." And whereupon she knocked him on the head and put him in the pot.
Oh my God.
and I thought, you know, that is exactly what happened. That's how we made the dog. You know, when we had these camp following wolf dogs or some kind of a dog that the early dogs that scientists are now talking about that came hanging around our camp, say, 30,000 years ago, we were not going to let them hang around if they were biting us or eating our kids or stealing our food. We were only going to let those that followed our rules stay around. And so if you're raising a group of these or having them close to you and one of them disobeys and does something wrong, that dog wolf got taken out very, very quickly. And that's how we did it. That's selective breeding. You chose the ones. We only kept those that were friendliest toward us, really wanted to abide by our rules.
I come armed with quotations today. And here's another one which comes to mind as in relation to what we've just been talking about. This is from Henry David Thoreau in Walden, who says, "I have no doubt that it is a part of the destiny of the human race in its gradual improvement to leave off eating animals, as surely as the savage tribes have left off eating each other when they came in contact with the more civilized. Compunctions about the eating of animals, not only the dogs who frolic about us in the morning and are served in a feast in the evening, but vegetarianism is a human choice, and it's very often a preoccupation. I find as I grow older that I'm more and more aware of eating animals. I haven't stopped. I'm not a vegetarian. But I'm sometimes rather tempted to think maybe I should be." How do you have attitudes on that?
Yes, I think about it a lot myself, especially as I was writing my book and since writing it, and struggle with it, as I think many people do in our society. I don't I'm not a vegetarian. I don't eat a lot of red meat. I mean, this isn't to make me superior in some way to other people or to, you know, try to tell people what they should eat or what they should enjoy or not enjoy. I think that generally people are omnivorous and that we are going to eat other species. And we're definitely going to eat plants. Whether or not the plants like it is also a matter of debate. But what I've come to and the way that I try to think about it is that if we are going to do this, if we're going to eat other animals, and it's most likely that we will continue to do so, then we should make sure that those animals have a decent life before we use them in that way. We're going to make use of animals, whether it's for leather goods or to put meat on our tables. And so I'd just like to think of us figuring out a better way rather than the industrial farming that takes place in which animals are so cramped and confined and misused. I try to avoid that kind of those animals that, you know, that type of meat product, I guess is the best.
And you probably favor fish over red meat, don't you?
I do, but that also is a health choice. Yeah. And so, and even with that, I have my problems because, you know, I certainly love salmon. I live in the Pacific Northwest and so I enjoy salmon. I had some last night, but I think about the salmon and they are a somewhat different fish because they do come up the rivers to spawn. And so they're at the end of their lives, for the most part, but the farmed fish, that's a huge problem that we're facing because we do need to have fish available for people to eat. Farming would seem to be a good way to go about it, but it is hugely problematic. And then we have problems with our wild fish stocks plummeting because, of course, we are overfishing. So I'm not, you know, I wrestle with all of these problems, I think, as most of us do. So I do eat a lot of fish and I eat a lot of chicken. I eat turkey on Thanksgiving. This year we were very consciously bought a turkey that was range free, antibiotic free, or raised, you know, range free and was free of antibiotics. And I can't say what kind of life that bird had, but I hope that as a range free bird, it was somewhat better off than those that are housed in very confined conditions.
The title of your book, as you well know, is Animal Wise. That's the book by Virginia Morell around which we are talking. We're hardly getting into all of the rich and wonderful detail. It is excellently written, and really quite captivating as one works through, the major chapters, which I think it might well be appropriate to quickly review, if only by the title of the chapters. And if I can turn these pages quickly enough, I will ultimately find that. Here we are. The Ant Teachers, Among Fish, Birds with Brains, Parrots in Translation, The Laughter of Rats, Elephant Memories, The Educated Dolphin, The Wild Minds of Dolphins, What It Means to Be a Chimpanzee of Dogs and Wolves. Excellent stuff. But you're talking both the subtitle, The Thoughts and Emotions of Our Fellow Creatures. What do we know about, say, the emotions of our dogs?
We know, actually, we're learning a great deal about that, and particularly in terms of their empathy for us and with us. And we scientists are able to look at that by measuring such things as whether or not your dog yawns after you yawn. Now, that's one measure of empathy in humans, is that if we see someone yawn, that the party that we're watching, we respond by yawning ourselves. And that's just a kind of a reflection of what happens in our brains. And so we respond because we feel connected to that person. We respond with a yawn. And our dogs, not all dogs, but often our dogs will do the same kind of thing. And it shows a very, very tight bond because they have some way of almost mirroring, not just in a physical way, but in an emotional way. They mirror what they've just seen you do. And we know that they spend a great deal of time watching our faces and that they watch with their, I'm trying to get this right, but I believe that they watch the right side of our faces, which is where our emotions first appear. and that's the part of the face that they fixate on. And I find that that is quite fascinating, too, that scientists have been able, by videotaping dogs and watching closely, they know what they're paying attention to, and it's first where the very first glimmer of an expression on our faces appears, and that's where dogs focus their eyes.
Do you know the case of Keith and Kathy Hayes and Vicky Hayes?
Tell me more.
Keith and Kathy Hayes were researchers at the Anthropoid lab down in Orange Park. It's since moved, I believe, to Georgia, to the University of Georgia. They decided they would raise a chimpanzee as their own daughter. They were,
okay,
and this
yes,
goes way back
yes.
To some, I don't know,
yeah.
40 years ago probably. And they took Vicky, who was a newborn chimp, only about 2 weeks old when they got her, and they took her home to mm-hmm. be their daughter, so to speak. Well, I was a graduate student at the University of Michigan when they showed up they had just done a book titled The Ape in Our House, claiming that Vicky had been quite significantly humanized, even had some words she could speak and had many, many, many more in her comprehension vocabulary. And they arrived at the University of Michigan with Vicky dressed in a nice little pinafore dress, as I remember it, and they gave her orders, go to the next room and pick up the blue pencil, which is on the table, and bring it to Kathy. And Vicky complied. Stuff of that sort. It was sort
right.
of impressive. The words she had were mama, I forget what the other one was. Her mama sounded like ma ma, and that was about what she could manage.
Right.
I tell all of this by way of background, coming to the punch line or to the payoff in the story. Keith and Kathy Hayes, despite their mutual love for Vicky, I guess lost their mutual love for one another, and they divorced. And she went to live with one of them, but not with the other. I forget which one. But after their divorce, Vicky died within the space of about 3 or 4 months. Those who knew the family said she died of a broken heart. I have no way. The actual disease that killed her was tuberculosis, to which captive chimps are rather prone. But there's a sign of possibly a very significant animal emotion, of course.
Oh, yes. No, I wouldn't doubt it at all. And certainly the story that Jane Goodall relates of Flint in the wild when his mother Flo died and how he just cannot get on with his life without her. She had never been able to really get him to live independently on his own. And he would still ride on her back even when he was 8 years old. And he should have long before then gone off and become a young male chimp, but he wanted to stay with his mom, and she just didn't have the energy to put up with his tantrums when she tried to separate from him. And so when she died, then Flint just lingered close to where he last saw her, and finally he himself died almost exactly at the same spot, just from lack of eating. And even though Jane and the others had tried to put out tempting food for him, he had no appetite. And all of these are signs of grief in animals when they become apathetic in that way and lose their appetite. And it usually almost, well, it happens when they lose someone that they're close to, that they've had a relationship with that's very close, that is a relationship of love. And I saw it myself in a cheetah who had lost his partner. I tell the story at the beginning of the book and how he's crying. The sound was one of the most pitiful sounds I've ever heard. And he's standing on top of this mound where he can look out over the savannah, searching for his partner, another male cheetah, and making this very sad sound and looking and getting down off the mound and sniffing around and then going back up on top to look across the horizon and make this cry. And the researcher said to me that, you know, if his partner didn't show back up, that he probably would die, and he would die of a broken mm-hmm. heart. He would become so apathetic, he would probably develop some ailment, and that would kill him, or he would be killed by another pair of cheetahs. But she said essentially the same thing. He was dying of a broken heart.
I have seen rhesus macaque monkeys who died of, not of broken hearts, but of never having been allowed to develop a feeling or a contented heart. What I have in mind are the mothering studies done by Harry Harlow at the University of Wisconsin. Yes. You know about those, don't you?
Oh,
what do you
yes,
make of all
yes.
that? Well, do tell our listeners what that was.
Well, Harlow had done these experiments. I maybe don't know them in as great detail as you do, but basically in which he he separated monkeys from their mothers at birth, and in some cases he had baby monkeys that just had each other, and so they were, I think he called them the together monkeys because they just clung so tightly to one another, and then other monkeys that just were given a kind of metal monkey or a wire monkey that was covered with some fur and had a bottle attached to it for nipple, and those monkeys too clung to that structure as if to a mother, but they never developed any proper social feelings or social
abilities. And even there, he ran two experimental groups. For one, the wire monkey was, as you've described, but the surrounding was terry cloth, which you could rub against and feel sort of cozy with. For another, there was no surrounding terry cloth covering the structure that provided the milk, but was rather just wire itself. So these were the monkeys with the wire mothers. They became demented very early and were just unmanageable, intractable, and indeed must have suffered a great deal, died young. They were just deprived of something which was essential, obviously, to mothers. The ones with the terry cloth mothers didn't do too badly.
But the whole experiment, I mean, what it showed I don't know what one can say other than at the time, given the fact that behaviorism had such a hold on the sciences and the idea that animals were just robots, that this was some proof that in fact that they weren't, that they were mammals.
Exactly.
What does a young mammal need? A young mammal needs to be held and cared for and loved.
They
by
need
its mother.
They need mother love, in essence, is what we.
They need it, yeah, and it's such a, and so in, they are inhumane experiments, but, you know, in a way it had to be done to begin overcoming this enormous injustice that animal behaviorism really inflicted on other species. And I think we're still, you know, the fact that we still have to say, don't worry, but, you know, be careful not to anthropomorphize, and do animals really have thoughts or emotions? Aren't they really robots? That we still go back to that as the base that we, you know, to start from, and that we have to constantly be saying we have to watch out for it and so forth. It surprises me, you know, that we still have not gotten that completely behind us. And every day, just for instance, yesterday I was elated to see this new study that's come out that shows that crocodiles use tools to lure other animals that they can then eat. So they put sticks on their snouts, and where they're close to, say, a rookery of egrets, and they know that the egrets are out there fighting and competing to get sticks to build their nests. And so they come sneaking up to the side of a rookery in the water. They look like a log, and they have a couple of loose sticks that they get and have them floating on top of their snouts. And the egret goes down to pick up one of those sticks, and suddenly the croc has lunch. Mm. So even in crocodiles, we see degrees of cleverness and intelligence that no one would have thought. But it's by paying attention. It's by going out and first accepting the idea that animals have brains, they have minds, that they're using them to make decisions, and that some of them can be very clever.
But you,
I mean, to grant them that.
But you ask in the book, what is it like to be a bat, to be a fish, to be, and I would answer to be a lion, say. We don't really know the inner life, though we do see much evidence of emotion, and depending upon how high up you go on the evolutionary scale, much evidence of intelligence and applied intelligence. But finally, one cannot understand what it is to be a salmon swimming upstream, or can one?
Well, we can't. I think some of the most interesting studies are those that are where they're now actually using some of the imaging, brain imaging abilities to see what goes on. So we know, for instance, that a laboratory rat that's solving a maze, and they make a map of the brain waves as it's working on finding its way through this maze. And then at night, they also have the electrodes on the rat's brain, and they can record the patterns as the rat is dreaming, and they're able to show that the rat And some of those REM stages is actually dreaming about where it was in the maze. So it's thinking. That's what we do when we're learning something new. We think about it in our REM stage. And so the rats mm-hmm. are working out that maze as they sleep. So we know that they probably have a kind of a movie going on in their brains. We know that also from one of the studies that I talk about in the elephant chapter, where Karen McComb was able to show that horses actually have an image of the horse of their friends who whinny. They know the whinny of another horse, and they have a picture in their mind that goes along with that whinny. They know that gold has a particular whinny, and it differs from that, say, of silver, their buddy. So we're getting closer. And then this year I went to visit with John Marslip at the University of Washington in Seattle, and he's taking wild crows and having them look at various things and then running them into a PET scanning machine so that he can take a picture of how they're processing things, such as looking at a dead crow or looking at a predator. In the wild, their behavior looks identical. They dive bomb, they mob, they squawk. A lot of birds come in, and they all seem to do the same thing, whether it's a dead crow on the ground or whether they're looking at a predator. But when you do these PET scans, they are processing both of those things differently. They are thinking differently about the predator than they are about the dead crow on the ground. And so that, again, that to me was really informative, because it shows us that you cannot just assume that by watching an animal do something and watching its behavior that you understand how it's thinking about what it's experiencing.
Final question, as we come to the end of the available time, and after I assert and reassert that the book by Virginia Morell, Animal Wise, The Thoughts and Emotions of Our Fellow Creatures, is exceptionally interesting, very well wrought, wonderful stories, and thought-provoking on every hand. But my last question is, what has the doing of this book and all the prior journalism about animals that you've done, what has that all done for you? How are you different by virtue of your journalistic interests and the way in which you've elaborated them over recent years?
I think very differently about animals, and it's just made my appreciation of animals so much deeper and richer. I look at them now and I say to myself, they have places to go and things to do, just as we do. And we have some young jays in our garden that we helped to save this summer. They'd been knocked out of their nest, and we called an animal rescue person who came over and got them and took them home for a week and raised them up and then brought them back to our yard. Those birds know us and watch us, and they know when we put out food for them. It's very interesting to me to have that relationship with them, and then just to watch other animals and to realize that they have minds and intentions and desires, and they have lives, and then they experience the world. And it just makes it a richer world for me, knowing that.
This is my very last question, and time has virtually elapsed, but who is that very wise, whether he's an ape or a monkey, I'm not sure, whom we find on the very cover of this book?
That's a rhesus macaque.
It is a macaque,
And I wish I knew more about that particular monkey. It was a photograph that the art designer of the cover found, and so the publisher thought that was an image that really captured and sort of challenged people with the idea that animals too have minds.
Well, he reminds you, as you look at him, of Rodin's sculpture of the thinker.
He's in the
same posture.
He has the thinker.
Yes.
Definitely has the same posture and a very knowing look
exactly.
in his eyes. And that's the other thing that we see when we really look at animals and give them a chance. You can see the wheels turning in
exactly.
their brains. And I think that says it all. And I just have to say again that my hat is off to the scientists I met who have spent all this time and energy doing tests and setting up things to find out what is actually going on in the mind of another animal, especially those that we can't talk
to. Well, Virginia, I thank you most sincerely for joining us. It's been a delightful encounter for me.
Likewise. I've really enjoyed it, Milt. Thank you so
much.
And
a cordial farewell.